sure where we're going, but all of us together can continue to do good work together, and we can continue to make a difference. Our time for today is ending, but I want to thank you all for being a part. Remember to help KBOO reach our 45,000 KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive goal by showing your support today at kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO at 44321. Every donation is appreciated. I'm Cecil. You've been listening to More Talk Radio, and I will see you, speak with you next time.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will be held on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios in North Portland. At the annual meeting, members will have the opportunity to meet candidates running in the board election. Final votes will be cast and counted. The results of the elections will be announced at the end of the meeting. Online voting is open now through the annual meeting at kboo.fm/board25. Paper ballots will be sent to members by mail. Again, that's KBOO's annual meeting and board election on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios, located at 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/board25.
It's time to make your voice heard and your impact matter. Join us for our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $45,000 goal by September 20th.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, and this is the KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive to raise $45,000 so we can keep bringing local, surprising, informed, important news and information to you. If you can hear my voice, please give as much as you can by clicking on the red Donate tab on the KBOO app or website, or by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you to all the KBOO members who make this station possible. We're going to be hearing more on today's show about why now is the time to join or rejoin KBOO or to increase your monthly donation. In our first segment, Old Mole and former KBOO board member Lori Mercier talks with Eugene Bradley, a longtime KBOO volunteer and former board and finance committee member, about the recent elimination of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the funding it provided to public broadcasting, including community radio. He discusses how KBOO has historically navigated similar financial challenges and persevered to support communities and provide critical independent programming about the city, the region, the nation, and the world. As others at KBOO have noted, the destruction of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, is a pointed, intentional, direct attack on independent media and an effort to silence media outlets that speak out against the administration. These cuts support the spread of anti-intellectualism and state propaganda by taking resources from public media and bolstering privately owned corporate media outlets that support the administration's right-wing agendas. Silencing public media is a tactic historically employed by fascist regimes and authoritarian governments to control information, suppress dissent, and solidify power. A related attack on intellectual independence and accurate information is being directed at universities, and our second segment today looks at the ways the current administration has turned the Office of Civil Rights within the Department of Education from a neutral civil service office dedicated to working against racial and other discrimination to a core of Trump loyalists pressuring university administrators to crack down on academic freedom. Jan Hocken talks with Jennifer Ruth about how Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act has become the primary legal instrument for repressing student protests and free speech on college campuses in the name of combating anti-Semitism. Jennifer Ruth is a professor at Portland State University and co-author of the book It's Not Free Speech, Race, Democracy, and the Future of Academic Freedom, and co-editor of the collection The Right to Learn, Resisting the Right-Wing Attack on Academic Freedom. She and Jan are also co-directors of the film The Palestine Exception, What's at Stake in the Campus Protests. You'll be able to find the audio of this episode and its segments on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find links to subscribe to the show and to support KBOO and oppose fascism by clicking on the red donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage at kboo.fm. We turn now to Laurie Mercier and Eugene Bradley.
Good morning. We're honored to have as guest today Eugene Bradley, who is a longtime KBOO volunteer. He served on the KBOO board from 1998 to 2006 when he had terms as board chair and treasurer. He has been a member of the KBOO Finance Committee since 1998 and has volunteered in numerous capacities over the years. Thanks for joining us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Gene.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on the Old Mole. What an honor.
Well, let's start by providing a brief overview of KBOO's history. Then we can talk about your involvement with KBOO and how the recent Corporation for Public Broadcasting cuts are part of a longer pattern of efforts to curtail free speech radio. KBOO's origins followed on the heels of California activists who established KPFA Pacifica in 1949. As the first non-commercial listener-supported First Amendment community radio. In the mid-1960s, a few dozen volunteers in Portland launched KBOO, which introduced the area to a range of classical jazz, folk, and alternative rock music, as well as a variety of political guests, such as the Berrigan Brothers and Joan Baez. And over the years, KBOO expanded its reach with more powerful transmitters, expanded its volunteer corps and programming, and in 1982 moved to its current building, which it now owns. Gene, when I first moved to Portland in 1995, someone told me about KBOO, and it immediately became my main radio source. And I still think it makes a difference in the quality of life here, having access to alternative political and music programming. And it's so important for Portland's progressive organizing. This is reflected in the recent Willamette Week poll that ranked KBOO as the area's favorite radio station. How did you first get involved in KBOO?
Well, I came to Portland in 1976, and I have to admit, I didn't listen to KBOO very much. I used to see the listener guide, which would be a newspaper that came out once a month that was in all the free newspaper rack. And I had a couple of friends at work who had shows on KBOO, usually in the middle of the night. But one of my friends, who was the president of the local letter carriers union, we were sitting across the table one day doing business. And he said, you know, have you ever thought about coming into KBOO? And I said, well, I don't know. What's that about? He said, well, we're really looking for board members. And I had had some experience as doing citizen budget review for the Portland School District for about 5 years. So I thought I knew a lot about numbers, mistaken in that. But So I came down to KBOO and looked around and stuff, and I thought, well, this is someplace I can make a contribution. So I talked to people about running for the board, and they said, well, you have to do a little volunteering first so people know you're serious. So I did a janitorial shift for on Thursdays for about 3 months, and they started to think I was probably going to show up again. So I put in my application, and I was elected in October 1998, along with Shahid Hamid. And I think Celeste Carey was re-elected that year. So people I've traveled with for the last 25 years or so. But just before the election, I think it was August of 1998, I went to a KBOO board meeting just to find out what it might be like to be involved in that. And they spent most of the meeting talking about they'd lost their CPB funding, and they thought they would have enough money in their line of credit at the bank to get them through until the pledge drive in the fall. They were counting on the Grateful Dead Marathon to save them once again. And I was like, well, this is certainly a different hand to draw to. So I joined the board, and luckily they had somehow talked Alan Bailey, who'd been a manager in the early 90s, to come back with a specific goal of trying to make an application to restore CPB funding. And just a short comment that when I joined, KBOO had 3,485 members. And we had the good fortune of getting a grant from the Meyer Foundation, a capacity building grant to hire a membership director part-time, and that was Arthur Davis. And Alan and Arthur and a very active board and a dedicated staff managed to get the membership up, I think in 2005, to 6,600 people, 6,600 KBOO members. So almost doubling the number of membership. In fact, they got to 5,000 in about 2 years. And our pitch at the time to the community was, we have to be independent. If we're going to do the work that KBOO does, to be independent, to tell the truth, to represent views you're not going to hear on CBS or NBC, we have to have financial independence, and we need you to support this. And the community responded incredibly, with incredible enthusiasm. We just, we had more and more volunteers, we had more and more listeners, and we had a supporting membership. And when things arose over the years that I was on the board, when, we needed a new transmitter, we could go and ask people, and they would make really incredible, generous donations to underwrite that. So community support has been constant. And whenever we've really been in touch with our membership and our listenership and our communities, and whenever we've gone and said, here's our plan, we need your help, and it was a plan that made sense, they've stepped up again and again and again and again. And it's been one of the most amazing experiences of my life to be involved with KBOO, because you just don't get this in ordinary life, the dedication of a whole community to keep something going.
Well, that sense of community and people stepping up, I mean, I've witnessed that many times as a volunteer at KBOO. I mean, what is your sense of why KBOO is so special and important to so many area residents?
Well, I think first it's the whole history of KBOO, the KBOO story. I mean, it was started by a bunch of volunteers. They were in a basement downtown in a law office. And it's just been chapter after chapter after chapter of just when you think it can't possibly work, they figure out a way to make it work. And literally generations of Portlanders and generations of Oregonians, people in Washington, people at Doubt the Gorge, people at the beach, have come in and done work and contributed and kept it going. And it is so important. One of the things that helped us, 1998 to 2006 or whatever, was the fact, sounds strange, the Iraq War. The Iraq War broke out, 9/11 and all that stuff. And KBOO was literally the only unembedded source of news that people could get. And I don't mean to disparage other media outlets that we know and love, but we were the only people. KBOO was the only place that were putting people on the air to ask questions and tell the truth. And people just, KBOO became a thing. And it was that way during the Timber Wars. It was that way during the Trojan nuclear plant trip, long journey. It's been that way again and again. Police accountability, so many issues that are important to Portlanders and have been over the decades. KBOO has been the one where you're going to find out people talking about that. And people like Celeste Carey and Shahid, and I can't even name so many names, have been drivers in that. People on the Old Mole, certainly. People on the Old Mole.
And that source of alternative information. Well, when I say alternative, I mean truthful information, honest information that's missing from the mainstream corporate media is still important, although KBOO has more, I wouldn't say competition, but associates now with social media. So there are many great podcasters, YouTubers out there that provide important alternative information that, along with KBOO, has helped to poke holes in the Israel narrative, for example, which the corporate media constantly repeats and has been disguising the genocide in Gaza. So we depend on KBOO, its broadcasting of Democracy Now!, and other kinds of programming to get that kind of important alternative information. And you also mentioned this kind of democratic participation. There have been many times when KBOO has faced challenges, whether from misguided board leadership or community efforts to support staff efforts to unionize. But the pandemic, I mean, what role do you think the pandemic has played as another recent watershed for KBOO and another challenge that we're still feeling at KBOO?
I think the pandemic has changed just about everything in our lives. But at KBOO, it certainly has had a huge effect. You know, prior to the pandemic, there were just a lot of people in that building and down on 8th Avenue all the time doing volunteer work, not only on the air, but also putting together the program guide and getting the mailings ready. There were just always people at KBOO. You could walk in day or night and there can be people in the hallways doing something. And people had a sense of working together, a sense of comradeship, if you will. During pledge drives, people would come in and answer the phones or, you know, bring food in from restaurants or whatever. There was just a lot of ways to participate in KBOO. When we had to close the station down, one of the amazing things about when the station had to be closed and people had to work remotely is how many programmers, like 85% of the programmers, learned how to do their shows remotely. That's a mind-boggling number if you've ever met some KBOO programmers. No names, but it was incredible. The program director at the time did just an amazing job of setting people up with training, getting that done. But the fact is, even today, you know, there's no role for people to come in and play in the building at KBOO. And I think that has changed the real dynamic of the community. And there's, you know, because of staffing, and, you know, staffing has perennially been a problem at KBOO, there's no one there answering the phone if you call up right now. You might leave a message and somebody will get back to you. And my experience is they usually do, but you can't just talk to somebody. You can't say, hey, I want to talk to Chris Merrick in programming about a program I heard, or call Kathleen Stevenson and ask her, who was that person who was just on Sluss and Cecil's show? So that's changed everything. And I think that we've sort of lost contact with a lot of people. A lot of people have lost their personal ties to KBOO. And I think that's a real challenge. And I know that other organizations and other civic places, gathering places, have really been affected by that. And that's one of the big challenges going forward. And of course, it's keeping up with the changing face of the media in terms of what equipment do you need to do your job? I mean, podcasts, people with phones now can, you know, make videos and all kinds of things. So it's rapidly changing, but how do we pull that back in to something that plays a role in the community as far as truth telling and information sharing and just communicating?
Right, especially in terms of programming at the local level, providing key information about what's happening in the city, the region, as well as the nation and world. And we should talk about the Corporation of Public Broadcasting cuts. I think most listeners, KBOO listeners, know about this, that Trump's Republican Congress recently cut all funding to the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. And this has devastated community radio stations across the country. KBOO's budget, which has always been bare bones, you could probably testify to that, Gene. Oh. We've never been able to fund enough staff members or get the latest equipment. There's always challenges in the aging building, plumbing issues, et cetera, that need expensive attention. But you've been involved on the finance committee and on the board and other times in KBOO's history when CPB funding was cut. And can you tell us what KBOO did in those years to function without it? and more generally about the impact of CPB money on KBOO's budget over the last decades.
Yeah, KBOO, since I've been looking at budgets, 1999, I guess, the CPB contribution is usually run about 8 to 10% of the budget, of our operating budget, paying salaries and things like that. So it's been an important source. Specifically, when we lost that money in 1998, because we didn't conform with the new standards that CPB was trying to impose on the stations that got grants from them to please the new Republican majority in the House of Representatives led by Newt Gingrich, if you remember that character. At that time, we thought, okay, how can we do this? We have to grow our membership. And so we really worked hard. And over the 4 or 5 years, we became self-sufficient. And that was the message that the board and KBOO as a whole was really pressing. We need to be self-sufficient. We cannot be dependent on the whims of, you know, who's going to be in control of the House of Representatives next year. Now, Alan Bailey, and a person I greatly admired, really believed that the government should pay for community radio because he said, that's our taxpayer money. That was a core belief. And Alan spent his entire second term at KBOO constantly on the phone to CPB people getting that grant. What do we have to do? This is how much we're doing. He was just working. His goal in life was to get CPB money restored to KBOO because he thought that was right. That's the way it should be. What happened was wrong. Now, of course, it's a completely different scenario. This gang currently in power has just abolished CPB, just as they've abolished USAID. They've abolished, pick a name and a hat. They've abolished as many things that they think are not favorable to them or against their ideology of the people spending money to support the public good. So it's a different thing. But I still think one of the things we can do is just make an effort and reach out and try to tell people this. We have a story to tell, to tell people we really need you. Our survival and our independence depends on you renewing your membership. I used to tell people that wherever I went, I would talk to people and then they'd say, oh, I'm a KBOO member. And it always came out that they had been a KBOO member, but they hadn't contributed in a couple years. I mean, Portland is filled to the brim with people who believe they're KBOO members, and they are. They're KBOO supporters. We need them to send some money. we need them to send whatever they can spare, $20 a year, whatever you can afford, whatever contribution you can make. Now is the moment. I mean, in so many aspects of our life in this country right now, now is the moment. And it is if you see the value and the sense and the virtue of having KBOO still on the air, continuing. It's a much more complicated thing now. It was a whole different world back in 1998. I don't need to tell anybody that. But many people have so many options for how they get information, how they get news. But the Oregonian had a piece recently about, I think it was fire maps and how it got defeated because they didn't have good communications. And the article pointed out that in communities where radio stations and newspapers no longer exist, people turn to Facebook groups for their information. And we all know how Facebook works. You get to hear from people who agree with you. You don't get any other information that may make you question what you're being told by your Facebook group. So that's why KBOO and places like KBOO and OPB and all those places are so critically important. And their independence is vital. You know, if somebody's going to lean on you like they leaned on television networks and say, we really don't like that guy on late night TV, he's got to be gone. And the oligarchs who own corporate media are going to respond to that very quickly because they understand the negative consequences of disagreeing with these characters. Being oligarchs themselves, they understand how that works.
Right. And it seems like alternative community radio is more important today than ever. For those reasons, Gene, it seems to me there are fewer alternative sources of information. I mean, maybe to those of us who know how to seek it out, we can find many more alternative sources of information. But for people in the mid-1960s, when KBOO was started, at least people had access to labor union newspapers or other kinds of community groups. And there wasn't the kind of single or count on one hand the corporate media owners that now exist. There was a bit more diversity in sources in the mid-60s or even in the 1990s. So I think more than ever, it's important to have KBOO's voice on the air and also to preserve that space on the band so that it's not taken over by some right-wing radio source. And there are plenty of those if you travel outside of Portland on the AM and FM radio dials.
You know, when they the FCC set that up, you know, the left side of the dial was reserved for local organizations, for community groups to have their local radio stations. And it's always been frustrating to people who believe in a quote unquote free market that they can't sell those. You know, the role of governments is to sell these franchises and make money. That wasn't the vision when they set this stuff up, and it shouldn't be the vision now. So yes, holding on to our place on that radio dial is very important. And lots of people over the last 25 years have said, oh, people don't care about that. They have the internet. They can just do whatever they want. That's true. You can dial up Amy Goodman on the internet, but you're not going to get everything that KBOO has without a lot of looking, and a lot of stuff's not going to be there. You want to talk about police accountability in Portland, you might get people's opinions. You might get advocacy groups one way or the other. You may get something from the powers that be, but you're not going to get a journalistic look at what the facts are and what the different opinions are and how things are working. You're just not going to get that because there's no money in it.
And the KBOO Evening News provides such important information and voices that are missing from the Oregonian or Willamette Week or the local TV stations. Our local news team is, you know, on a different kind of beat looking for those stories that are missing.
Yes, and they're looking for the story that's not told, the part of the story that's not told. Now, the Oregonian, goodness knows how many people work at the Oregonian anymore, but they don't even have time, probably, to go too deep. And since it's only about 15 pages, they don't have space to go too deep. KBOO has 24 hours a day, and thanks to volunteers, we have a lot of people to follow up on a lot of things. And that's a huge advantage that we've had during our whole existence. We can do things that more established news sources or community sources can't do, and volunteers make that possible.
Well, Gene Bradley, thank you so much for talking with us today and for your many, many years of volunteer service to KBOO.
I'm just one of so many people who have done so much to keep this place going. I'm in awe of them still. So thank you very much, Lori.
Thank you, Gene. So long.
Take care.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on.
That was some of Mavis Staples singing Eyes on the Prize. And before that, Lori Mercier talking with Eugene Bradley about the history of KBOO. I'm Fran Michelle, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Lori and Gene's discussion makes clear that although our taxes really should be providing us with public services, including public media, KBOO has at times in the past been autonomously supported without government funding, and it can be again. It can if we make it so. We are currently in the KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive to raise $45,000 so we can continue to provide the local news that corporate outlets won't or can't report and the critical perspectives that the current administration finds objectionable. Please give as much as you can by clicking on the red donate tab on the KBOO app or website, or by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Don't let 90.7 end up getting turned over to Clear Channel Media or St. Clair Broadcasting. Thank you so much to those who have given to KBOO, who have renewed or restored your memberships, who have started a monthly sustaining membership or increased the amount of your monthly donation, or who have just become new members. Thank you all. And please plan to join the station's annual meeting, Saturday, September 20th, at Mississippi Studios and online. In our next segment, Jan Hocken talks with Jennifer Ruth about how the current federal administration is attacking universities, misusing the Office of Civil Rights within the Department of Education to pressure university administrators to repress student protests and free speech. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 grew out of the civil rights movement and its demands for legal protections at the federal level around practices of racial discrimination, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act stipulates that, quote, no person in the United States shall, on the ground of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance, end quote. Yet this anti-discrimination law is now being used to discriminate against those who oppose genocide, inequity, or exclusion. Jennifer Ruth discusses this move in a recent article in Mondo Weiss, linked on the webpage for this episode. We'll hear a clip of President Lyndon Johnson presenting the act in 1964 before we hear the conversation between Jan Hocken and Jennifer Ruth.
We must not approach the observance and enforcement of this law in a vengeful spirit. Its purpose is not to punish. Its purpose is not to divide, but to end divisions, divisions which have lasted all too long. Its purpose is national, not regional. This Civil Rights Act is a challenge to all of us to go to work in our communities and our states, in our homes and in our hearts, to eliminate the last vestiges of injustice in our beloved country. So tonight I urge every public official, every religious leader, every business and professional man, every working man, every housewife, I urge every American to join in this effort to bring justice and hope to all our people, and to bring peace to our land.
You just heard President Lyndon Johnson in signing the Civil Rights Act of 1964, one of the most important, if not the most important, pieces of legislation in U.S. history. The act, with its 11 titles on different areas of the legislation, grew out of decades of organizing for civil rights and racial justice. The legislation prohibited discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. It outlawed segregation in public accommodations, public education, and federally assisted programs, and it also made employment discrimination illegal. Well, welcome again to KABU, Jennifer Ruth.
Nice to be here. Thank you, Jan.
Well, you are co-author of several books on free speech and academic freedom, and you're co-director with me on The Palestine Exception, a film that draws out history behind the campus protests of 2023 and 2024. In an article you published this month, you described the Trump administration's expansion of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act and investigating universities as a tool in the repression of pro-Palestinian protests under the guise of fighting anti-Semitism. Use of Title VI was used by some administrators to crack down on protests during the college encampments in 2024, as we may recall. Well, can you start with explaining a bit of what Title VI encompasses and how the current Department of Education is using this law?
Sure, thanks. So the Title VI, Protection from Discrimination, has been part of what universities monitor, making sure that they're in compliance with Title VI is part of what they monitor and hire equity and compliance officers for. And you listed some of the things that the civil rights law, Lyndon B. Johnson, 1965, what it was trying to prevent discrimination around. In particular, Title VI protects from race, color, or national origin discrimination and makes sure that all students have access to all aspects of university and campus life, and there aren't any barriers by way of discrimination. It can also, though, it's important to note that in recent times, there's been more of an emphasis on a clause was added also in Department of Education Office of Civil Rights in 2017, Know Your Rights, Title VI, and Religion Fact Sheet, that stresses that the harassment discrimination could be based on actual or perceived shared ancestry or ethnic characteristics, citizenship or residency in a country with a dominant religion or distinct religious identity. Because one of the things that the use of anti-Semitism as a cudgel, or as many people refer to its weaponization, as a way to try to control pro-Palestinian speech, Palestinian in academic research, and universities themselves intimidate universities themselves.
Yes, and also limit criticism of Israel.
Right. That's in the IHRA definition in particular, which the Trump administration has pushed very hard for everyone to adopt. And many schools are adopting it out of fear of federal investigations or federal funding being withdrawn. But the emphasis on religion and shared ancestry, perceived or actual, is just in the last few years. And it's definitely about trying to suppress speech around Palestine and suppress criticism of Israel.
So on the face of it, and as we look at what the Civil Rights Act gathers up and reflects of a history of the civil rights movement, it's laudable and important to defend. So how then do we parse the important and progressive potential of this, like the Title IX around sex discrimination on campuses had an important thrust to it and impact, but Title VI now is being rolled out in a different way or in a more expansive way in repressing more broadly forms of activism on campus, academic freedom, free speech. Can you say more about how that's being played out?
Yeah, first I just want to reference the first thing you said, which is that combating anti-Semitism is a laudable goal. There's no question about that. And a lot of people are arguing, and it's the narrative is gaining some traction, not just in Jewish Voice for Peace circles or Jewish Currents or some of the more progressive Jewish organizations, but also in mainstream magazines. So, for example, IL Press has an article about the Columbia's adoption of the IHRA definition in The New Yorker that came out yesterday. And he stresses, as many people are stressing, that this weaponization of anti-Semitism and weaponization of Title VI actually does the opposite of its intended effect, in that it makes Jewish people more vulnerable because it's a misuse. And it's a misuse of the term anti-Semitism. It's a misuse of the law. And it's distracting us from the attention on the groups that are overwhelmingly more responsible for anti-Semitism in American life. And that's the right wing. And I would used to say far right, but it's the very blurry continuum now between mainstream right wing and far right. But the groups, the nationalist groups, and you can see the sort of original KKK type groups that were discriminating against all minorities and violent towards all minorities, that it distracts us from the real threats to anti-Semitism, not to mention that the use of it to suppress speech about a genocide, speech about the trauma of Palestinian Americans and Arab American students. I'm speaking always in the context of higher ed, so I'm not speaking about, of course, the enormous trauma of Arab Americans, more generally Palestinian Americans and Palestinians themselves. But it's the students. It sort of willfully ignores and erases the suffering of Muslim students, Palestinian students, American students. And so it's hard to imagine, as IHRA presses, something about how the resentment of this weaponization of anti-Semitism isn't good for combating anti-Semitism either. So there's that.
Let me just add a point to that line of critique, because I think one of the perverse paradoxes of using Title VI to pursue claims around anti-Semitism is that it warns against the potential disciplinary action for people who make assumptions about a group based on their physical characteristics. So the assumption that Jewish students, if they're wearing a Star of David or a yarmulke, are Jewish and therefore are Zionists. And the critical argument around this is that there is also this assumption on the part of how this is being used that all Jewish students are faculty or all Jews in general support a particular view on Israel. So it does the very thing it warns against by making assumptions.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Assumptions about what it means to be Jewish.
Yeah. Part of what it's doing in conflating Jewish identity, Jewish religion, national origin, shared ancestry with the Israeli state too, is making it such that it's actively conflating things that absolutely need to be kept separate if we want to combat anti-Semitism. Actual hatred of Jewish people, not criticism of genocidal acts of an Israeli state, not any number of things, right, that are paramount for free speech, that are fundamental for free speech. Exactly.
And part of the traditions of discourse and political difference with respect to Zionism.
Oh, yeah. The whole history of Jewish anti-Zionism is erased there. And in fact, some of the early lines of critique around the fact that in the name of combating anti-Semitism, they're stoking it, came from Jews critical of Zionism, who felt like the way in which the discourse around anti-Semitism that the right wing and now the federal government was mobilizing was itself anti-Semitic in terms of erasing anti-Zionist Jewish people. So to get to the Department of Education, the Department of Education for 25 years, it would investigate complaints around Title VI, Title IX, you know, any of the aspects of federal law, discrimination law that have the strings attached that if a university or college is found to be non-compliant, that they can revoke federal funding. For over 25 years, the Department of Ed's Office of Civil Rights, which I'll probably refer to as OCR, has never done that, has never withdrawn federal funding. It has never paused federal funding. It has investigated, but it's always worked with universities and colleges in a spirit of trying to come to some kind of agreement around what's best practice on their campus. And it's never, under the Biden administration after October 7th, I had a lot of problems with the way that Catherine Lehman ran the DOE's OCR. And I feel that she was way too vulnerable to certain kinds of really propagandistic narratives around this. Nonetheless, there wasn't the kind of full-scale, hyperbolic, rhetorical attacks. For example, when Harvard's at one stage of the assault on Harvard, where they gave rulings or findings that Harvard had been indifferent or had stoked. I can't remember that language, but it was absurd language, as if Harvard as an entity, presumably the entire top administration, had tried to fuel, I think fuel was actually the verb that was used, fuel anti-Semitism, which is ludicrous. And so this kind of language around it is new and unprecedented. The thing that I want to mention too is the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, or OCR, it had certain standards for investigating complaints, and it couldn't be simply what a group on social media whose whole bread and butter was trying to trump up, make viral claims that somebody had said something anti-Semitic or done something anti-Semitic, which now there's, you know, so many of those. And they take something like someone else's tweet or X post and they reproduce it and they paraphrase and gloss what it says. And then when you read the thing that they're glossing, it doesn't say anything of the sort. It doesn't say kill all the Jewish people or any of the ridiculous things that these groups say. And yet these are the groups that the federal agencies now are relying upon for building cases against universities and against individuals. And they are finding their complaints through social media. And these groups now are actively tagging Leo Terrell, who's the head of the Joint Task Force on Combating Anti-Semitism that Trump announced in January, and that now has 60 universities under investigation. It's tagging Harmeet Dhillon, who's the acting assistant general of the Civil Rights Division in the Department of Justice. And it's also threatening withdrawal and freezing funds without actually conducting an investigation. So before, the Department of Education's OCR would actually conduct an investigation, present the findings to the university, work with the university to ameliorate the situation, and at no point even pause funds. Now we've got a situation where these federal agencies are freezing funds, withdrawing funds before they've even conducted an investigation and making claims about anti-Semitism as if the investigation's already happened. So one of the things, I mean, one of the reasons I'm confident and talking like this about their practices is because former civil servants who worked in the Department of Ed are now coming out and saying there's no way that they've done the proper investigation because they've fired all of us or forced us to quit because we didn't want to conduct improper investigations or find rulings that are being forced upon us that we don't think are justified by civil rights law. They're saying we know that they're not doing things appropriately, and there's no evidence that they're doing things appropriately. And just in the last maybe 3 weeks, we're seeing a lot more journalists being confident and making those claims. The other thing to note is the Department of Education Office of Civil Rights was absolutely gutted after Trump's inauguration. And so at one point, there was no experienced civil rights lawyer on staff. And so it's political appointees that have driven these investigations with the untransparent help of right-wing organizations that these political appointees already had ties to from their previous right-wing careers. So the other thing is that the Department of Education, which is the one that did this kind of thing with universities, worked with universities and college, a lot of its duties have been taken up by the Department of Justice, Department of Health and Human Services. And so it's being spread across different agencies, which I think actually was probably driven by the need to spread it across more political appointees' hands than one particular agency could pull together. So that brings us to the point of the article in Mondo Weiss around schedule policy career and what's happening to the civil service.
There are a number of these executive actions, aggressive pushes all over the place to roll back everything that represents American political progress.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, reminding you that part of the rollback of political progress is the defunding of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but you can help resist the attacks on media by giving to KBOO in this, the KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive to raise $45,000 by clicking on the red Donate tab on the KBOO app or by texting KBOO to 44321. Okay, back to Jan Hocken and Jennifer Ruth discussing the attacks on education.
There are a number of these executive actions, aggressive pushes all over the place to roll back everything that represents American political progress, including this obscene and perverse use of the Civil Rights Act. And many lawyers and legal organizations have said that these actions are not legally defensible in many cases. And with this specific initiative around using Title VI to punish universities and crack down on criticism of Israel and the Palestinian justice movement, that these are not defensible legally, but right. They're such a stretch of the categories of Title VI and the history of how it's enforced, which involves establishing there was intent on the part of the university or the institution to promote the bias that they're charged with. And many of these cases, there are activities on campuses that are not under the control of the administration. Campuses include a lot of things going on. So this gathering up of social media complaints and evidence that is not defensible from a normal legal standpoint has been called out. But the point is then raised that this becomes such an onerous task for universities or public institutions that receive federal funds that it's better to just do something to show they're cracking down than to draw out this long and complicated process. Is there anything you would add to that in terms of something that's indefensible legally but still has enough threat attached to it that it acts as a powerful incentive for universities to participate in these bogus investigations?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about for the universities to participate, but for them being willing to settle.
They have to participate some way. But
right, they're legally forced to, and they have been happy. I mean, they've been seemingly quite happy to. Many of us would have liked them not to have handed over the names of student protesters early on when we saw that this was a lawless government that was going to do things like abduct them and send them to Louisiana, and they did it anyway. So they're participating, but they're settling without taking it to court and forcing the proper methodology and actual full investigations, etc., so that they're not forcing the department, these agencies, and you know, there's different ones at different moments. They pull on whoever I think is available at the time to do something, whatever political appointee group. that they're not forcing them to prove or to show their evidence or anything like that. And I think that's right. I think it's because reputational damage is so great the longer this goes on. And also there's the sheer fact that this Trump administration was ready and they had Project 25. They had a lot of things in place and they are ready to use a number of tools to crush higher education. And if a university shows any fight, I think first let me be clear, universities have to show fight and they have to fight these things. And the more that they don't, the worse it's going to get. And the longer their power is going to continue. But from the university standpoint, a university that shows any fight is going to, they love a fight, right? They're all about the fight. That this is the way they govern, is by picking petty fights or inappropriate fights or distracting fights. And so they'll then use a bunch of other tools to attack that same university. So that's one of the fears, is that, okay, well, we don't just sort of settle this, even though we know there's no grounds for it, and we don't go along with their claims, they're going to come after our international students. They're going to come after this. They're going to come after that. And the thing that's frustrating is, of course, the so far in the timelines, even when a university is settled, they have come after those other things anyway. But that's one of the fears. And then there's the fact that, yeah, stuff happening in the courts takes a long time. And in the meantime, stuff can stay frozen. The funds can stay frozen. And if you want those funds released sooner rather than later, you're incentivized to settle. Finally, I would say that there's a real concern about the Supreme Court, that if a judge, for example, Judge Stephanie Gallagher just ruled for UCLA, or no, ruled against the DEI order and said, you know, no, this was improperly done. The fear is that, okay, great, temporary win, but they will appeal and it will go up to the Supreme. They'll use other tools and they will appeal. And there's not a lot of confidence in the Supreme Court right now.
No kidding.
So that's part of the variable in university settling.
I want to make sure we get to having you talk about the potential sites of resistance, pushback, where this gets located at the university level in terms of compliance officers.
Well, first I need to explain the civil service stuff before we even get to the equity and compliance. This is a really neglected piece of the terrain right now. And that the imminent landscape for these attacks on universities and colleges. And part of it is because it's incredibly boring and tedious and wonky. And it means tracking a blitzkrieg of Trump executive orders and how they're being operationalized in the federal agencies. But I do feel like it's important to see this coming and to make sure that people who are in a position to choose, for example, you know, the Alan Garbers, the people at the top of their universities, the people who are in a position to make the call about whether we fight something or we go along to, you know, minimize immediate damage, it might change their calculus. It might make them more willing to fight. Okay, so what it is that I'm referring to is that the second day after he became president for the second time, Trump assigned executive order restoring accountability to policy influencing positions within the federal workforce. People might be familiar with this because this was used to be Schedule F, which was part of Project 2025, and which Trump tried to implement his first term, but towards the very end of his term, and Biden immediately reversed. Well, this is another version of Schedule F, now called Schedule Policy / Career. And what it does, what's important, I'll try to make it really as untedious as possible. What it does is it swaps out career civil servants who were in these positions for, you know, decades and who were adjudicating civil rights complaints through Obama, Trump's first administration, Biden, Trump now and Trump's second. The people who have long experience and who don't make decisions based on partisan preferences. They make decisions based on law and experience and knowing the case law. So these people, what Schedule Policy Career does, swaps them out for essentially another layer of political appointees. So I could go into detail about exactly what that means, but no one wants me to, you'd have to just trust me that I have the receipts to show that this is about creating political appointees. It's not doing the things that Trump administration is using to justify it, which is, oh, it was too hard to get rid of civil servants before, there were too many protections for them. Oh, they, you know, they work too slowly. You know, they have a number of reasons that they give for why they're doing this. But the long and short of it is that whereas in a normal administration change, regime change, 4,000 civil servants at the very top are political appointees, and they change with each administration. Now we're looking at stated 50,000 that will be essentially political appointees. And you know, there's language to explain why they are political appointees. 50,000. And that many experts, and again, these are experts that are not in higher education, right? Higher education's kind of not, doesn't have their eye on this ball. But of course, people who have been in civil service, non-governmental civil servants, organizations, nonprofits are noticing this. And they all say the number is very likely to be much, much higher than 50,000. So if we in higher education are familiar with the importance of the protections of job security, tenure, due process, the best way to explain scheduled policy career is to explain that we will have between 50,000 and 350,000 positions that have no job security and are will be evaluated not on the basis of fidelity to the Constitution, experience and knowledge of the law, but literally their performance evaluations are the degree to which the measure to which they can be shown to have furthered Trump's agenda. So the civil service is about to become the political troops of Trump's administration. So what this means, this is really important, what this means is that if all of this damage that has happened to universities and colleges just between the Trump's inauguration and today, there was massive damage, right? We're all in shock. That's been done with a very small group of mostly political appointees. After scheduled policy career is implemented, they will be able to scale up their tactics, find creative new tactics hugely. So we're looking at a potentially different playing field come fall because of this change in the civil service. Okay, so now as far as resisting goes, first, if we know this, universities have typically looked at Office of Civil Rights, Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division as another arm of the law. This is the law and we will be compliant with the law. If university heads understand this is a profound subversion of the law, this is the supplanting of party politics for the law, perhaps this sort of mantra around, well, of course we'll be compliant with the law.
No longer holds.
Yeah, they'll see, at least privately, they will have a very different understanding of what they're saying when they say something like that.
In closing, I think we should return to this in September. Something that can't just be summed up with a call to action now. It involves a long-term ongoing strategy of resistance and enlisting people, including compliance officers.
Correct.
That pressure, many of them come out of background and
civil rights law.
So let's plan on a part two.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
They've created this army of right-wing enforcers, and we have to mobilize our own troops in resistance in a way and on a level we haven't done before.
And we have to make sure that the people in our universities who are in what those of us who are faculty might consider more bureaucratic positions, the equity and compliance officers, the student discipline, the student life people, all of these people need to understand that they have more common cause with us than they do with federal administration that is really just a variant of Trump and party politics. It's not the law as it used to be.
Well, thank you so much, Jennifer Ruth, for being here today and to kind of lay out this very dark landscape we're looking at with even more ferocious right-wing assaults on not only the social movements that have led to laws that protect vulnerable groups or oppressed groups, but the very foundation of education. And this also includes attacks on K through 12, but much of it is focusing on colleges and universities. So we'll have you on the OMOL again to follow this, hopefully in the fall.
Sounds good. Thank you, Jan.
Thanks so much for being with us today. Jennifer Ruth.
That That was Billy Bragg singing All You Fascists Bound to Lose. Before that, we heard Jan Hocken and Jennifer Ruth discussing the need to get organized to resist these attacks. Professor Ruth notes that university administrators have been far too ready to capitulate to the federal administration. I would note that some administrators are taking it on themselves to dismantle programs. Southern Oregon University is trying to cut their program in gender, sexuality, and women's studies, and the University of Oregon is trying to cut a number of programs, including religion, classics, and Russian. I'm sure the planned elimination of the program in Judaic studies will help with anti-Semitism. You can contact administrators to let them know what you think about these changes. All of us need to be vigilant in organizing and supporting the interests of free inquiry and free expression wherever we are. We are at KBOO Portland. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Fran Michelle, reminding you that one place to support free expression is right here, with the KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive to raise $45,000. Click on the red Donate tab on the KBOO app to fight fascism, or visit kboo.fm/give, or text KBOO to 44321, or mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thank you to all of KBOO's members, listeners, volunteers, and staff. And thanks to all of the contributors to today's show. Joe Clement for the theme song, Laurie Mercier and Jean Bradley for their discussion of KBOO history, and Jan Hocken and Jennifer Ruth for their discussion of attacks on universities, civil rights, and civil service. We'll be back next week with more about the loss of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and more views from the Mole's Grounds Roots perspective. We'll go out with more of Billy Bragg's All You Fascists Bound to Lose. All you fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO's Loud and Proud. Become a member during our KBOO's Out Loud Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made, community radio.